for cover, while natives looked up to the skies with hope, and people in the region celebrated the beginning of Iran's retaliatory strikes against the Israeli entity. Well, stay with us as we look at what it all means, Iran's retaliatory attack on the Zionist regime, and now what's likely to happen on this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of Bethlehem, New York, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer Scott Ritter. Out of London, historian and author Shivan Mahendraraja. Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off I'm going to start it off in London, actually, with Shivan. And the Israeli regime being an invincible power has been a narrative that the Western hegemonic front, along with the regime, has propagated for decades. And, of course, the resistance front has been destroying the narrative for years now, from Hezbollah to Hamas and now Iran, with its retaliatory strikes inside of the occupied territories. Your thoughts about how this has affected the Zionist regime, actually losing this narrative and understanding that it's definitely not invincible.
Well, thank you very much for having me here. I'm actually honored to also be with Scott Ritter on the show. So I actually think that this is really an eye-opener for Israelis, and I mean just ordinary Israelis as much as it is for the government, because this narrative of invincibility has been built up for many years, but also the younger generation has not experienced war. They have not had to go into air raid shelters, nor have to hear air raid warnings like their parents and grandparents did up through the Yom Kippur War. So this raid of something like 185 drones, some 110 ballistic missiles, they came in from different parts. So all of Israel was lit up with air raid warnings, about 750 air raid warnings, I believe. I could be wrong. But anyway, a lot of people are going into shelter. They were panicking even before this. And now that sense of security is gone, because this is actually a very successful raid. Now, there are people who are saying, oh, well, only about three or four missiles hit, everything else was shot down. Actually, no, because what they did was to overwhelm and to confuse the air defense systems of Israel, plus all the people who were helping Israel, Jordan, U.S., France, Britain, and the U.S., of course. And the targets were hit, what they wanted to strike. Some of the other missiles and drones were shot down, but it was at a huge cost, not just financial cost, but in terms of the interceptors that were used. They cannot keep doing this if they want to escalate with Iran, and Iran keeps launching wave after wave after wave, day after day. At some point, Israel is going to run out of missiles, because these things just can't be manufactured overnight, and there is a limited amount of stock, and the U.S. has to hold on to some of the stock that they have for their own purposes, as well as all the other things that they want to do in terms of, you know, a war with China, or in case NATO needs them. So anyway, I think this is quite successful. And it was what I call a reconnaissance in force, by the way, in the sense is that they use a fair amount of force, but not overwhelming force. And I think the Iranian IRGC airspace learned a lot about Israel's air defenses from what happened yesterday, as to what can get through, what Israel can throw back up at them. So that if this escalates, there is a lot that they can use.
Okay, stay with me, Shivan. Sorry to interrupt. Let me get Scott in on this conversation. Well, Scott, I mean, your assessment of Iran being able to penetrate the Israeli airspace and several layers of its defense mechanisms.
Well, first of all, I want to echo everything that your guest Shivan just said. He's 100% correct. This was an extraordinarily successful attack by Iran on Israel. We need to understand, first of all, the objective of the attack. It was to prove a point that Iran could, in fact, strike Israel at a time and place of its choosing. Iran made a decision, I believe, in this attack to limit the scope and scale of the attack so as to not give Israel a reason to retaliate to the Iranian retaliation. The Iranians wanted to demonstrate a capability, put Israel and its allies, including the United States, on notice that Iran possesses a viable deterrence, and that Iran will strike those who strike Iran, and that the price that will be paid will be heavy, and therefore nations should think twice before attacking Iran. And I think that this objective was achieved. We see that by the United States pressuring Israel not to launch an attack, and Israel not pushing back very hard, because Israeli officers, you know, you talked about this narrative, this concept of Israeli invincibility. Israeli officers, and I've worked with them in the past, are very professional. They're very realistic, and they know what the truth is. They have, for the past 2 years, conducted war games where they exercise a scenario that has Israel being attacked simultaneously by Hezbollah, by Syria, by Iran. And a key aspect of their thinking going in, of the calculations they make, is the effectiveness of their air defense systems. And you have politicians in Israel who give high credence to Israeli air defense. And you have the military that's more balanced, more realistic. They know for certain now that their air defense will not stop an Iranian attack. That if Iran was to launch a full-scale attack, combined with Hezbollah, Syria, and others, that they would overwhelm Israeli air defense and inflict devastating, if not lethal, damage to the Israeli state. And so this is the impact. The Israelis now know for a fact that should they ever attack Iran, the consequences to Israel will be devastating. And this is the element of deterrence that Iran wanted to establish.
Okay. Well, speaking of that element of deterrence, Shivan, do you think in general that with Iran's attack on the Israeli regime, that there is now a different paradigm which has been established, and that the Israelis realize that they will have to answer, Tehran will make them answer, perhaps even inside the occupied territories, for any type of aggression that they may initiate against Iran?
Yes. What has happened before is that since Iran was practicing strategic patience, there were many commentators and probably some, you know, in intelligence services and the military as well, who probably, you know, in Europe, U.S., Israel, who thought Iran was scared, that they were afraid to actually hit Iran, to hit Israel, but they would only use quote-unquote proxies to do the work for them. What happened today shows that Iran is more than willing to strike into Israel. And the announcement that the age of era of strategic patience is over is, I think, a very big announcement, because now what they are saying out of Tehran is basically, you hit us anywhere on our soil or in Syria, we will strike you at home. No more of this quote-unquote proxy business. And that, I think, should be a very, very strong lesson. But I think there's also the other factor which I would like to add in here, which also gets into the deterrence, is that now some of this information is very preliminary as to how many were launched, how many were shot down, what happened. But there is one good estimate out there that says only about 50% of Iran's ballistic missiles were actually shot down. And this should scare not just the Israelis, but the Americans as well, because the systems used by the Israelis for the most part are American. Now think about what's happened, what would happen if Israel does manage to create a regional war, which is what Netanyahu wants, which means the United States gets involved. Now, Israel has a very thick air defense blanket, but some of the American bases, in certainly in Syria and in Iraq, but also in some of these other countries like Qatar, don't have that kind of air defense capability. And if Iran can get through to Israel's air defense, Israel's air defenses, they will be able to overwhelm American air defenses in Syria, Iraq, Qatar, UAE, and Kuwait. And that should scare the Americans into thinking, you know, Israel, don't do anything stupid.
Okay. Well, Scott, as you said earlier, Iran initiated a calculated and limited response against military sites. Now, why do you think that Iran gave a controlled response? And also, I'd like to look at the example that Iran is showing by not attacking civilian areas, but only military targets. I mean, much opposite of what, unfortunately, we have been witnessing the last 6.5 months in the genocide in Gaza.
Well, I think, first of all, we have to point out that Iran did not initiate the sequence of events that led to this, to the need for this action, that Iran is responding to irresponsible and illegal behavior on the part of Israel, behavior that isn't just limited to the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but has extended to Israeli involvement in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists on Iranian soil, etc. Your other guest, Mr. Shervin, talked about Iran's policy of strategic patience, but it's more than that. Let's look at what Iran's been doing diplomatically in the last year or so. One, normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia. That's a very big step that shows that Iran is not posturing itself for regional confrontation, but rather regional stability. Iran has joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has joined BRICS, which means that the Iranian focus is not on military aggression, but economic prosperity, economic cooperation. Iran has been struggling under international sanctions for decades now, and they are finally seeing a pathway to where they can look at normal economic relations with a good percentage of the world. Iran's not going to throw this away in an irresponsible military behavior. Iran is not looking for a fight. But Iran also can't stand by and allow Israel to carry out an attack of this nature, because left unpunished, Israel would just be more emboldened to do bigger and bigger acts. So Iran had no choice but to carry out an act of this nature. But this action was designed not to be decisive. I think people need to understand that. This was a deliberate act of constraint on the part of Iran, because they are not looking for a war. They are looking for peace. They are looking for stability, but they had no choice but to reestablish a policy, a posture of deterrence. And they've done that. It was a very calculated action on the part of Iran, both in terms of how they did this. What nation broadcasts the fact that they're going to attack another nation 5 hours in advance? And yet that's what Iran did, by sending out in a very publicized manner its loud Shahed drones. They told Israel, here we come. You have 5 hours to move your critical material away from stuff. Look at what they targeted. They didn't saturate an airbase. They hit one or two runways. They hit some empty warehouses. They let Israel know that Iran can look at a point on a map and hit that point on the map. But they also let Israel know that Iran deliberately avoided the high-value targets, deliberately avoided the places where they could generate high numbers of casualties. Iran was not looking to punish Israel. Iran was simply looking to put Israel on notice that if Israel continues this behavior, Israel will be punished. But Iran is not looking for a fight. Iran is not looking for a war. Iran is looking for regional peace and prosperity that, is engendered by stability, political stability, not the instability of conflict.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, what about that, Siobhan? You heard what Scott said, that Iran is not looking for a fight. But when we look at the reactions, whether we're talking about, you're in London, Rishi Sunak, and what he said, for example, after the Iran's retaliatory attacks, and saying that, again, the UK stands with Israel and condemned the Iranian attacks. And, of course, we saw the same thing coming from other various Western countries. Your thoughts on that? Because this continual scenario that this Western hegemonic front has tried to show as Iran basically being the bad guy, the terrorist, and of course then the Israelis being the defenders of democracy. I mean, do you think that we're transitioning, that more and more people understand that lie now?
I think so. I think, you know, what has happened over the last 6 months has changed a lot of minds all across the world. Even people who were formerly, you know, very pro-Israel have turned against Israel given what has happened. There are, for example, some very strong conservative voices like, I think, Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, who have actually been critical. And I think the narrative is changing. People like Rishi Sunak and that EU person, von der Leyen, or whatever they call her. I mean, you know, people are just tired of them. I actually don't even read their tweets or their stuff because it's the same thing that's recycled. And I think this is true for millions of people around the world, that they just see these Western leaders as hypocrites who talk about democracy, civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but they don't actually exercise it. And I think these 6 months of Gaza has exposed that. So I don't know who listens to these people anymore, except those who are deeply devoted to one particular narrative and will not change their minds. I mean, you see lots of Jews. Like, you know, I was home in New York in October, and there were lots of Jews. I'm a New Yorker. I'm living here. But I saw lots of Jews out there protesting, you know, what was going on in Gaza. And this is really one of the things that the media do not want to talk about, is that the Jewish view of Israel is not monolithic. And you can see that in the major Western cities and capitals as well. So I don't know who Rishi Sunak is trying to convince, except, you know, like what we call preaching to the choir, maybe.
Right. Well, looking at this Western hegemonic front, Scott, we saw that last night during Iran's retaliation attack, that France, UK, US, Jordan were all involved in actually trying to shoot down Iranian drones. Your take on that? I mean, what does that say about the Israeli regime itself? Does it mean that it does not have the capacity to take on Iran at all or alone? And what does that do for their own self-confidence in being that they could not do this alone?
Well, first of all, we need to understand that Israel has war gamed out this scenario. And so they know the data. And they know what their saturation point is when it comes to their air defense ceasing to be effective against incoming targets. The other thing is the United States, France, Great Britain, they are part of this game of keeping Israel out of a broader war with Iran. And so it was in their interests to shoot down these targets. Iran wanted them to shoot down these targets. Iran sent overwhelming force that required the United States, Great Britain, France to put up their airplanes, to bring in their air defense, to come to the assistance of Israel, to mitigate the potential damage that could be done. And it was also a signal to all parties that Israel cannot stand alone, and therefore it's in the interest of these parties to keep Israel out of a broader war, because in order to save Israel, they will have to be involved. But the same missiles that hit targets in Israel with precision accuracy can hit a British base in Cyprus. They can hit a French base. They can hit American installations in the Middle East. All of these nations now know that Iran has a capability that can hurt them in a time of conflict. And so this was and sort of this act of grand theater where Iran and the United States, they wrote a script, because the United States did not want, the United States knew that Iran had to strike. They understood the political reasoning behind it. They didn't want Iran to launch an overwhelming attack, and they let Iran know that. And Iran, not wanting a broader war, replied by sending enough force to send a message, but not too much, so that the United States could write a script that had its aircraft, its ships coming to the assistance of Israel, demonstrating friendship, at the same time that Joe Biden picks up the phone, tells Benjamin Netanyahu that the United States will not participate in an attack against Israel. So we're friends under certain circumstances, but the friendship is not limitless. This is, again, part of the script that Iran was shaping. I think the Iranians deserve far more credit diplomatically as well, that this is not just a military victory. This is a diplomatic achievement of some note.
All right, and last question, Shivan. We only have like a minute of time, but there were videos being shown last night, Palestinians celebrating. Gazans are saying it was the first time that there was no buzzing of drones over their heads, and also Palestinians in the West Bank even approaching the, trying to tear down the apartheid wall. Let's talk in general about what could it mean. I mean, Iran has penetrated Israeli airspace, but if the Muslim countries were truly independent and united, what could that mean for the Palestinians?
Well, I think there was a great deal of cheering going on from Muslim countries. I saw comments from Pakistanis. I actually tweeted something from the Taliban where they were actually praying for success.
Well, I'm mainly talking about the Muslim countries right on side of the Palestinian territories.
Oh, right. Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, that's kind of difficult because, I mean, you know, their rulers are very much in terms on the side of the United States, and they will do what the United States wants them to do. So I'm not quite sure how much benefit there will be for the people, even though they will privately cheer. And I'm sure Jordanians and Lebanese and so, and Saudis and so on may have been cheering for Iran, but how that will benefit the Palestinian people is very difficult, because governments are not going to be supporting the Palestinian people.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Scott Ritter, former U.S. Marine Intelligence Officer out of New York, Shivan Mahendraraja, historian and author out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight right here at Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, slowly but surely, you're gonna get there. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we are talking about slowly but surely you're going to get there as a part of your Islamic lifestyle. So of course, you know, we've got these interesting titles on A to Z every now and then, humbly at your service, trying to make this as interesting and fun as possible. So what are we talking about when we're saying slowly but surely you are going to be able to achieve a certain thing when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle? Well, that's pretty much it. It is this idea that overnight one cannot become this super Islamic lifestyle individual, right? It takes time, it takes practice, it takes effort, it takes determination, and it is a slow process, but it is slow and steady. So, for example, you know, sometimes we kind of get all excited and we're going to read 50 pages of the Holy Quran every single day, and the first day you do it, and the second day you do it, and the third day, you know, you start to think, well, it's 50 pages, and the fourth day you kind of cut down to 25, and by the time the second week comes around, you just don't even want to look at the Holy Quran anymore. See, this is the opposite of slow and steady. So it's like, for example, all of these things are different kind of medications. The daily prayers, the Holy Quran, the recommended mustahabbat, you know, all of these things are these, I guess, their medicine, their cure, their healing powers. And if you overdose on these things, well, then there you go. You have overdosed on these things. And so the slow and steady, it's funny. That's the parable about the rabbit and the turtle, right? The turtle was slow and steady, and he ended up winning the race. And the rabbit was, you know, quick and fast, but, you know, he eventually lost the race. And so the slow and steady, meaning that we do something when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle in a manner where we do it continuously. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about slow and steady when it comes to trying to achieve something in our Islamic lifestyle. So now, slow doesn't mean necessarily that, you know, you're just incredibly slow. I'm only going to read a one rakat, one unit salah on this day because I'm going slow and steady. No, you know, we should be honest with ourselves. We should be honest with the Almighty Allah, who He is looking at us, He is hearing us, He knows what we are thinking, He knows what our intention is, right? He knows why we are doing something. So, you know, we might be able to deceive ourselves, even though that is quite difficult as well, you know, but we can definitely not deceive the Almighty Allah. And it is Allah, you know, at the end of the day, who is going to either reward us or punish us for those things that we did for the sake of Allah or for those things that we did against the commandments of Allah. So, you know, slow and steady means that, okay, I'm going to make sure, and, you know, and it, you have to sit down and make a program. And I mean, you know, sometimes you need help with this, and I wish I could help every single one of you, you know, but you need help so that, for example, it varies in cases. An individual who doesn't pray any prayers of the five daily prayers, you need to pick one and start praying those continuously, and then move on to two, then move on to three, move on to four. But, you know, do it continuously. And whatever you do, this is the formula, is to do it steady, do it continuously, and keep on doing it until it becomes a natural part of your Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After days of anticipation, Iran unleashed a barrage of missiles and drones against Israeli targets in the occupied territories. The legitimate response came after Israel attacked Iran's consulate in Damascus on April 1st, violating all international laws and conventions.
Iran's response comes within the international laws, specifically Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which gives Iran the legitimate right to defend its national security. The Iranian attack on Israel has changed the geopolitical map in the region, and it was a strong warning to the evil regime.
The Iraqi people, as well as resistance leaders, hailed the Islamic Republic for the unprecedented response, dubbed Operation True Promise, which was within the inherent right of self-defense that entitles any country to protect its diplomatic institutions. Iran's retaliation came after the UN Security Council failed to condemn Israel's attack, which killed 7 members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps.
The resistance and the people of Iraq surely stand by the Islamic Republic of Iran amid the failure of international community and the UN Security Council to condemn the Israeli attack on the Damascus consulate. Iran had all the rights to defend itself and respond with proper means and timing.
The significant operation clearly shows that Iran will not hesitate to take action against any threat to its citizens and institutions. Now, with its capabilities and military evolution, Iran has significantly changed the rules of battlefield in modern times.
Iran's retaliatory operation, which came after a long time of strategic patience in the face of Israeli's brutalities, shows that the Tel Aviv regime's days of hit and run are over. And Iran does not hesitate to exact a devastating revenge on its enemy, despite its all-out Western support. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
Iran's retaliatory strikes on Israeli-occupied territories have drawn admiration and praise in Afghanistan from both the country's ruler, the Taliban, and the Afghan people. They said the reprisal strikes were completely legitimate, justifiable, and have expressed their support for Iran in the face of hostilities.
Long live and fingers crossed to the leader of Iran and to the brave nation and IRGC of Iran for their bravery in hitting the occupying Israel. They did this while many Muslims, like Saudi rulers, are indifferent to the cause and values of Muslim world. Praise Ansarullah of Yemen and Hezbollah and any nation who stands for the Islamic and human rights of Muslim people. We are happy that Iran carried out the retaliatory strikes on Israel. Every Muslim should feel proud because the bully occupying Zionist regime came under fire. Look, Israeli forces have been oppressing our brothers and sisters in Palestine for decades. It's the time for all Muslim countries to unite and show the aggressors that we can and we have such capabilities.
The Taliban-run foreign ministry issued a statement on Sunday declaring Iran's recent attack on Israel as a legitimate defensive action. It added that Israeli genocide must be stopped in Gaza. Experts say the Afghan ruling authorities' support for Iran's reprisal actions and the Palestinian cause shows Muslims are now united against Israel, and hatred towards the Tel Aviv regime is now everywhere across the Muslim world.
Decades of Israeli occupation in Palestine and its atrocities have made all Muslims hate this regime and call for the regime to be crushed. Over the past few years, the attacks carried out by Hamas and Hezbollah shattered the Israeli regime's grandeur. Iran's strikes against Israel came amid Israel's devastating and deadly bombing campaign against Gaza.
The Afghan people also show their anger with Israel for its war crimes in Gaza. They call for an immediate ceasefire in war-torn Gaza and demand that the international community help end the war and support Palestine in the face of Israeli invasion. Afghanistan stands firm beside brotherly Iranian nation. Palestinian cause is bringing the two neighbors even closer. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Described as an act of self-defense, the Yemenis regard the extensive missile and drone strikes carried out by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps on the Israeli-occupied territories as a response to the Israeli regime's assault on Iran's consular building in the Syrian capital, Damascus.
We consider the Iranian strikes against the Israeli entity a legitimate attack and a response to the Israeli attacks that violated Iran's sovereignty by hitting its consulate in Syria. The Iranian attack is a legitimate move to punish Israel and is part of measures to stop the regime's ongoing crimes since October 7.
The public sentiment aligns with the official stance as locals overwhelmingly endorse the Iranian strikes, stating that the Israeli regime and its allies only understand the language of force.
The Iranian attack is supported not only by Yemenis but also by all free people in the world. The Iranian response sent the message that Iran's capability is real and that all it was seeking was to liberate Palestine and stop the crimes by the Zionist enemy. Today we are facing an exceptional operation because Iran had not carried out an operation of this scale since the end of the Iran-Iraq war. Iran has been characterized by patience and deliberation due to the way it deals with hostile states. This is the first time that Iran has carried out a military operation against its enemies from within Iranian territory. This attack was successful, came at the right time to put the Zionist enemy in its place, and proved that Iran is capable of blowing up Israel.
Over the past few years, Yemeni-Iranian relations have strengthened, especially during the U.S.-backed war on Yemen, initiated by the 2014 revolution. This military campaign aimed to restore a U.S.-aligned former government in Yemen.
People here believe that the recent Iranian attack against the occupied territories significantly impacts Western powers, demonstrating unity among the resistance forces in the region. They view the attack as the beginning of the end for the Israeli regime and its supporters. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Pro-Palestinians in France gathered the day after what was reported to be the first peaceful night in Gaza in 6 months. The reason? The night before, Iran launched a historic missile retaliation against Israel, which prevented Tel Aviv from continuing their attempt at genocide and ethnic cleansing. At the demonstration, there was widespread approval, support, and even gratitude and admiration for Tehran's counterattack against the unprecedented bombing assassination at an embassy.
Je suis pas antisémite.
I'm not an anti-Semite, and as a Muslim, I want us all to live together peacefully, but I see Iran's attack as something good on their part. Iran is the only major country which has had the courage to attack Israel and defend Palestine's innocent civilians. This war can easily stop if Israel can finally realize that they are attempting a genocide.
Those who are occupiers do not have the right to legitimate defense, but Iran does have the right, and they used it to defend Gaza as well. Israel bombs and assassinates people constantly. How can people forget about what Israel has done?
Protesters contrasted Iran's actions with those of the French foreign minister last week. After mentioning the possibility of placing sanctions on Israel over Gaza, he immediately backtracked the next day in front of Parliament.
The French government is quite the accomplice in the genocide that Israel is waging right now. Why aren't there any sanctions despite all these deaths? And when France talks so much about defending human rights, it's simply shameful.
French forces claim to have contributed to Israel's defense. In a major blow to perpetual Israeli hopes of escalating the violence, Washington has already refused to join any potential Israeli attack on Iran. It's uncertain if the cycle of Israeli assassination and Iranian retaliation is now concluded, but Israel has already returned to indiscriminate bombing and mass murder in Gaza, despite 6 months of global outrage, the murder of 34,000 Palestinians, and 76,000 injuries.
Will Israel pursue an even wider war? Will more Arab nations be inspired to join the cause of defending Gaza? What's certain is that many are happy that, for one night at least, the guns aimed at Gaza's civilians finally fell silent. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Pakistanis are showing staunch solidarity with the Iranian retaliatory strikes against the Israeli-occupied territories. Social media platforms overflow with messages of congratulations for Iran's effective response to Israel's atrocities, hailing Iran as a courageous champion of Muslim states willing to confront a Zionist regime, especially following months of atrocities against the Gaza Strip.
We are proud of Iran for taking a stand against Israel's aggression. The Palestinians have been suffering for decades, and it's time someone took action to protect them. Iran's attack shows that they won't tolerate the oppression any longer.
I fully support Iran's decision to strike back against Israel. The Palestinians have been living under siege for decades, and it's high time someone stood up for them. Iran's actions give hope to oppressed people everywhere.
The Pakistani government has echoed both the sentiments of its citizens and voiced grave concerns over escalation of tensions in the Middle East. Islamabad underscored the Israeli blockade of Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the recent wave of tensions, emphasizing the urgent need for international intervention to prevent further escalations in the region.
Iran has done the right thing legally and morally, because Iran has retaliated against Israeli unwarranted aggression and attack on Iranian diplomatic installation in Damascus. And that was a violation of UN charter and international law. So what Iran has done is the right thing. They have responded in kind, and they have taken the battle to the aggressor, and they have hit Israel.
The people of Pakistan emphasize the urgent need for global intervention to halt the escalation of conflict in the region and call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Iran's attack on Israeli-occupied territories has garnered widespread support from Pakistanis, particularly due to their perceived alignment with the plight of people in Gaza. The warm reception of Tehran's operation by the Pakistani nation highlights its desire for a more assertive response to Israel's ongoing atrocities against Palestinians. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
German police have stormed the pro-Palestine conference in the capital Berlin and arrested a number of participants. The Palestine Congress was an important event for the Palestinian solidarity movement in Europe. It was set to be held in the German capital from April 12 to 14. The participants aimed to denounce Israeli apartheid and genocide and Germans' complicity in the genocide of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
We are the Palestine Congress. We accuse the Israeli state of carrying out genocide. And we accuse the German government of supporting, of abetting, of making possible this genocide.
On Friday afternoon, several hundred activists assembled in South Berlin to attend the conference. Soon after the conference started, it was interrupted by the city's police, which had dispatched more than 900 police officers to the area. Outside the conference venue, police officers arrested a man for hoisting a Palestinian flag on a building. The participants inside the conference venue also faced repression. Even the registered journalists were refused entry by the police officers who had been deployed inside the conference hall.
I was in the list, and as the moment as I came, they told me I'm not allowed to enter because there were too many people already inside.
The first part of the conference focused on the history of Palestine.
May marks 76 years since the Palestinian Nakba. 76 years of colonization, of forced exile. However, next month also marks 76 years of resilience, 76 years of a struggle for liberation.
The German police stormed the event during a speech by the Palestinian researcher Salman Abu Sita, who addressed the conference via video link because he had been not allowed to enter Germany. Police said he was subject to a ban on political activity in the country.
The Palestine Congress was happening. We were watching a video. The police came and shut down the electricity. They didn't give a justification about it. They didn't tell us why. Nevertheless, the police came here, shut it down, said it in the loudspeaker. People are supposed to leave the building right now. You see, they're already taking people.
Chaotic scenes followed. At least two people were arrested inside the hall and several others were interrogated. German Interior Minister Nancy Faeser hailed the police, saying it was good how the police had reacted.
An hour after the start of the conference, German police stormed the conference hall because of a speech on the history of Palestine. In an act of extreme repression, they broke up the conference, declaring it an illegal assembly. However, the Palestine Solidarity Movement vows to continue the conference. Dieter Reinisch from Berlin.
Just one day after France's foreign minister earned praise for saying that sanctions on Israel could be coming over their refusal to allow humanitarian aid to Gaza, he quickly backtracked in a session before Parliament. Many are saying the episode revealed the uniquely powerful sway Zionism has in France.
France, although it has the biggest Jewish community in Europe, has also the most extreme right-wing anti-Palestinian Jewish community in Europe. And this community, this Jewish community in France, has a lot of saying and a lot of control over the media, over the political class. So you have very few people within this community who are protesting what's going on in the Middle East. Not like the United States and Great Britain.
The majority of France's Jews fled from former French colonies in Africa once those countries gained independence in the 1950s and 1960s, and they reportedly brought with them stringent anti-Arab and pro-imperialist views. In 2019, French Parliament controversially and incorrectly equated anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, and they are currently reviewing a proposal to fully criminalize anti-Zionism.
They're saying straight, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. Therefore, any criticism of Zionism, any criticism of Israel, means you are a criminal because you're an anti-Semite. And so it's killing all debate. Now, all throughout the collective West, but especially in France, the number one threat to freedom of speech is the Zionist movement and the pro-Israeli movement. And I weigh my words because it's very, very dangerous to say something like that in France because you'll find yourself in court.
Since October 7th, support for Hamas and even support for Palestine is often being prosecuted as so-called apology for terrorism. Pro-Palestinian demonstrations were banned nationwide for weeks, leading to thousands of fines on protesters, with protesters arrested and prosecuted for apology for terrorism for as little as carrying a Palestinian flag. Without the ability to openly criticize the policies of Israel, many believe it's difficult to imagine that Paris will reduce its unconditional support for Tel Aviv, no matter how many atrocities and war crimes they commit against Palestinians. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. Well, I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom.
I wish both of you luck and success. There has been studies that the rate of people killing themselves in today's world is 20 times as high as it was in non-modern world. So we're growing in a number of suicide cases. Now we have social media that connects us to this virtual world in which we do not know anything about people's inner conflicts. And what we are provided with is just the picture and the appearance of everything. Why people tend to kill themselves? Though they have connection to other people, now they have more of virtual friends. Now they're not, they seemingly claim that they're not alone anymore.
Oh, it's really sad, isn't it? I think in the modern times, our basic material needs have been taken care of. and we are in a state of kind of welfare. And while that should be a good thing, the gratefulness of human beings has not increased, and because of that, they're just killing themselves. If you look at the old time, before the modern era, people were really struggling just to survive.
Exactly.
And because of that, you know, they were really thankful if they are alive. Yeah. Whereas today, life itself is just taken for granted. We have vaccines, we have medical care, we have this, we have that. And a lot of our society is so materialistic that it's just about covering up. You know, you just cover up the diseases that you have instead of addressing them.
You mask it.
Yeah. You have a nose that you don't like, let's go get surgery. Just change it. You don't like this about yourself, just go and change it, you know. And because of it, it's become so superficial.
Mm-hmm.
And so the meaning of life has actually left people's hearts. And when the meaning of life leaves people's hearts, why live? And why stay alive?
And the other thing is that in today's world, we're being given more alone. It's not like that I have too many friends on social media. It's like I am limiting myself to social media. If I want to choose between going out with my friends or just chatting with them and staying at home, taking a rest, I would go for the second one. And this is what leads me towards more solitude. Leads a person, many even young people, towards solitude because social media is more fun. It's free and they can stay at home and just enjoy the wide world of the strange things, mm-hmm. the new things. And people, many, many young people are just interested in curiosity, in investigating the new areas. That's why they prefer to just use their phone, their tablets, I don't know, their laptops instead of the real world. And we are kind of separating ourselves from the real world and going through the
virtual world.
The virtual world, exactly. This case is just leading us towards more solitude. And that's why when we really need someone, we look around and we don't find anyone. There we go for depression and too many problems. And at the end, we can see the result of committing suicide.
Well, I must add something. When you say solitude, it connotes some positive feelings to me.
Yeah.
But it's
because
loneliness
it has some
that we're
aspects.
Suffering from.
No, it has some positive aspects at the same time. Like, solitude is something sweet for some people, but to some extent, you know, after that, it goes into just loneliness, then depression.
Exactly.
Even committing suicide.
Then committing suicide, unfortunately. So I guess this is just the introduction. Let's go for a break, and then we'll be back to see what's more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back. This is Back to Reality. Brother Muzaffar and Sister Nahid are with us. We're talking about suicide. And then we talked about the fact that in today's world we have connection to media, which is an unlimited world. We have access to different people, different resources of knowledge, and then there are a lot of things. Like, I remember someone was saying that in past we actually went through the memorization of poems, and it was so sweet and so nice. We felt like we do not know that much of poems, but we at least have two or three poems in our mind. What about now? We get thousands of poems and we remember none.
Yeah.
And this is something very difficult
not
to digest.
Poems, even phone numbers.
Yeah, that was just an example.
Yeah.
My father once got stuck in a situation. He left his phone at home,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to call one of us and say, like, ask us to deliver his phone. And he couldn't remember any of our phone numbers.
Oh my God,
while in the
so
past,
true.
Yeah, while in the past, we used to just memorize every phone number of even our then a grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, we are just being too much limited, too much addicted to our phone that we don't even think of the real world. Like, okay, what if I lose this?
It's a lack of appreciation again, right? We've lost that. We've taken things for granted.
Exactly.
Everything's been handed to us so easily that we don't appreciate anything anymore. Okay, first of all, let's look at the purpose of creation of humanity, right? The Holy Quran states, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنسَ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. We did not create the jinns or human beings except that they serve the purpose of life is to serve Allah.
To worship.
Many people in the West don't have that purpose in life. They don't recognize it. Many of them think that their purpose in life is happiness or to be socially active. And when you take those things away from them, why live anymore? And that's why they kill themselves.
Exactly.
I'm guessing that the suicide rates were way lower in Muslim countries. I'm just guessing this. I haven't actually gone and looked. Inshallah, the listeners can go and look. But I'm guessing that the suicide rate was way higher in the West because they don't have that purpose anymore.
Exactly. And among the people who have everything, like wealth, fame, everything. Yeah.
So, okay, and the second thing is, have you heard of the mouse utopia experiment? This is so terrifying. Please, please, please go and look at it. So the idea was that they're going to create a utopia for mice. Mice, usually they're living in the garbage. People are trying to kill